This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 14th of February. 18 years after Russia's President Vladimir Putin used the Munich Security Conference to accuse the United States of trying to dominate the world, today it was the US Vice President accusing Europe. J.D. Vance said European politicians were frightened of voters who dared to cast their vote outside the political mainstream. He told Germany's big parties who say they won't work with the far-right AfD, democracies don't have firewalls. We'll have reaction from a senior AfD leader after Mr. Vance met her party leader. Average life expectancy in the UK will rise for your grandchildren, even though it hasn't done for you. What's changed? And Abel Sechlochwey, the cellist fusing the classical music he studied in Manchester with the Bantu language of his South African home. It was at the Munich Security Conference 18 years ago that Russia's President Vladimir Putin accused the West of trying to dominate the world. US Vice President J.D. Vance was the star turn today, though he decided not to mention the sanctions and potential military action which, in a newspaper interview, he threatened Russia with if it refuses to make peace in Ukraine. Indeed, if the audience of diplomats, politicians and military personnel had turned up in the expectation of learning more about the Trump peace plan, they were disappointed. Ukraine was barely mentioned. Mr. Vance did carry a message with him, one with a curious symmetry to Mr. Putin's of nearly 20 years before. "There's a new sheriff in town," he declared, leaving his audience squirming in their seats as he accused Europeans of hypocrisy. They championed democracy unless they didn't like the result. They had retreated, he said, from the continent's traditional values.
Now, to many of us on the other side of the Atlantic, it looks more and more like old entrenched interests hiding behind ugly Soviet-era words like misinformation and disinformation, who simply don't like the idea that somebody with an alternative viewpoint might express a different opinion or, God forbid, vote a different way or, even worse, win an election.
Mr. Vance accused Romania's Western allies of pressing Bucharest to annul the results of last December's presidential election because of alleged Russian interference to promote a pro-Russia candidate. "Is your democracy so fragile," he mused, "that it can't rebut influence peddlers?" With Germans going to the polls next weekend, he rebuked the major German parties who say they won't work with the far-right AfD. "Democracies don't have firewalls," he said. The applause was polite, but not enthusiastic, for a speech Germany's Defence Minister Boris Pistorius clearly didn't think should have been made. He had this to say when he addressed the conference.
Wir kämpfen auch dafür, dass du gegen uns sein kannst.
We're fighting for your right to be against us. That's one of the mottos of the German army, and it also stands for our democracy. This democracy was just called into question by the US Vice President, for Europe as a whole. He spoke of the annulment of democracy, and, if I understood him correctly, he compares the conditions in parts of Europe with those in authoritarian regimes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not acceptable.
Germany's Boris Pistorius. Well, joining us now from Munich is the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Frank, you've had a chance to kind of test the mood after the conference broke up. How has the speech gone down?
Very badly. I mean, you know, unequivocally badly. It was extraordinarily poorly judged, I think. I mean, you know, I spoke to somebody quite senior in the kind of European architecture afterwards, and they said, but this was for US domestic consumption, pure and simple. Well, if that was the case, you know, it's hard to see what it achieved, because I don't know if anybody in America was listening to this. Well, President Trump was. He called it a very brilliant speech, you know, beautiful, actually, or something like that. And in Europe, they're losing their right of free speech or something which most people here would say was absolute nonsense. I mean, it was just utter hypocrisy. You know, when you've got a White House that's banning people who won't use the terms that it likes, and where President Trump himself, during his first term of office, branded anything he didn't like, he disagreed with, as fake news. So it was just extraordinary. And most importantly, it did not address what everybody came here to hear about, which is to get some detail on what is America's plan for ending the war in Ukraine without simply giving in to President Putin's demands. And I think that really is the nub of what this conference is still supposed to be about. I mean, I think, you know, when we look at it objectively in a few days' time, hopefully, you know, the Vance diatribe will be kind of brushed over and it'll be a return to business as usual, which is trying to safeguard Europe and end this dreadful war in Ukraine, but without making President Putin so much stronger that he comes back and takes more.
Vice President Vance isn't the only American official there. We were told that, certainly we reported on this program a week ago, that General Keith Kellogg was going, who is the man who has been charged with trying to kind of come up with the structure of a peace proposal. Has he been having bilateral discussions with European officials at Munich? Or again, has he not apparently been addressing this?
Well, tomorrow is the big day for this. There's going to be a big panel discussion on the main stage called Peace Through Strength, a Plan for Ukraine, which will involve Ukraine's foreign minister and General Keith Kellogg, who is a 70-year-old, very experienced, retired U.S. Special Forces, Green Beret, as far as I know. And he has been working with his team for quite some time now on a feasible plan for Ukraine. Now, the question that, or the risk, I think, that everybody's concerned about here is that too much has already been given away to President Putin. The Europeans have accused Donald Trump, the Germans particularly have accused him of being a terrible deal maker, that they've given away the crown jewels of negotiation by saying, yeah, don't worry, Ukraine's not going to be able to join NATO. We don't think that's really feasible. And Ukraine's not going to get back its territory that Russia's taken since 2014. And there won't be any US troops, etc. and so on. All of these things, which these are all Putin's demands. And if you give in to those before the negotiations even begin, then it puts you in a very weak negotiating position. That's the fear here in Europe.
Frank Gardner in Munich, thank you very much. Well, after delivering his speech, Vice President Vance met outside of the conference with Alice Weidel, leader of the AfD, one of the German parties excluded from the event. He declined to meet the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. Beatrice von Storch is deputy parliamentary leader of the AfD party, the Alternative für Deutschland. I asked her what happened at the meeting.
It went well. They were talking about 30 minutes or something, and it was a very good and friendly atmosphere. And I think he made very clear in his speech that he did not like the idea to not invite us to this conference and to build firewalls. This is what the other party is doing, to not work with us together. And so I think the speech he gave was really groundbreaking.
And you described it on social media, I think, as one of those dates that people will look back on and say something changed with this speech. What do you think changed?
I think he was crystal clear and he made two major points. I think the main thing he was addressing, that he is concerned about the state of democracy in Europe. And I think he is damn right. And free speech is fundamental for democracy. And free speech is in danger in Europe. They label it, as Vance said, in the Soviet area, words like misinformation and disinformation. They label everything like that. All the opinions they just do not like to hear. And they are increasingly censoring other people's voices. And then the second point he made clear is that there's nothing more urgent than mass migration. And that's the issue we are addressing.
The president's plan for peace in Ukraine, for bringing the war to an end. Was that discussed by your leader with Vice President Vance?
I think they talked about Ukraine, yes. But what is very, very clear also is that Germany at this point doesn't play a major role in the whole game. I do understand why that's the case. Our economy is shrinking. Our foreign minister is just a joke.
There are about, I think, 35,000 US troops currently stationed in Germany. The US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, said this week that that's something that in time Europe should expect to be reduced. I mean, that is going to put a bigger burden on Germany, isn't it? I mean, are you prepared for that, for an increase in defense spending, not only to meet that, but perhaps to contribute to the peacekeeping, which we're told would be needed for any peace deal that takes place in Germany? Because America isn't going to send troops for that. They're saying Europeans, including Germans, would have to do it.
Yes, we as AFD always address the issue that our army is not capable of serving what they should serve as member of NATO, for example. Mm. We are just too weak, and all the weapons we had, we delivered to Ukraine, so we're just blank. So we're very in favor of supporting our troops and getting our army well equipped. But at the same time, we now have to decide what burden we have to shoulder. We need to spend more money. We have to deliver our part in NATO. We might get involved in somewhat in Ukraine. We don't think that should be any kind of NATO troops in Ukraine.
You would be open to peacekeeping troops, maybe under the UN ambit or something like that.
Peacekeeping troops, yeah. Yes, but probably it's more intelligent to not have NATO members at the border with Russia, so that if anything occurs, NATO is not in war with Russia. I mean, this is what we should really be keen on. We are no longer able to have such a bad government, which is just crushing our economy, because we have to have money to spend on our army more than we did in the past.
Yeah, because you spend, it's about 1.5% of GDP, isn't it? Certainly was in 2023 that Germany spent. I mean, the Americans are talking about Europeans spending 5% of GDP.
Yeah, I think that's impossible, but that's impossible when you look to the budget. But spending more and spend it more efficiently is probably the best thing we can do.
I'm going to ask you this last question because it's based on this question of the firewall, which the larger parties have observed thus far, excluding you from any involvement in power in state government or possibly in federal government if that comes to pass after the election, if you're in a big enough position. You know the reason that they cite for it. They say it was the mistake that was made in the 1930s. The big parties thought they could control the far right. The far right ended up in control. The tail wagged the dog. And what followed was world war. How do you answer that, Chris? Because it's a genuine and sincere fear for a lot of people. It might not even be specifically about your party, but it is about the idea that radical right parties can distort the system.
My answer is this is just an excuse. Even the politicians who going against us with the argument of being Nazi, which is in Germany even worse than in any other country, is just an excuse because they do not want to come into argument with us because they want to stick to their policy line. They do not want to come into argument with us because they are in favor of mass migration. They are in favor of wokeness. They are in favor of LGBTQ and everything. They are in favor of stopping nuclear power plants and carbon power plants. That's the green woke leftist ideology they have in their bones. And so when there's another party with reasonable arguments in all of these areas, they do not want to argue with us because they will lose the argument because they don't have any on their side. So what is the easiest way to attack a party is to say you're Nazi, especially in Germany. It's very easy because no one here wants to be a Nazi. But then this ideology of the parties is also supported by the media. So they come up with the argument, this is a Nazi party, don't listen to them, don't talk to them, don't invite them, don't let them participate in any kind of talks or conferences, just exclude them from society. And then the rest of the people, the majority people in the street, they of course get what is in the media and then they believe what is said by media and by the politicians.
That's Beatrix von Storch. She is deputy parliamentary leader of the AfD. Well, before his speech, JD Vance held a meeting in the margins of the conference with the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy. Whether he warned him that the UK might feature in his speech, when it did, it was to provide an example of where, in his view, Europe has gone wrong.
Perhaps most concerningly, I look to our very dear friends, the United Kingdom. where the backslide away from conscience rights has placed the basic liberties of religious Britons in particular in the crosshairs. A little over 2 years ago, the British government charged Adam Smith Connor, a 51-year-old physiotherapist and an army veteran, with the heinous crime of standing 50 meters from an abortion clinic and silently praying for 3 minutes.
Vice President Vance is referring there to what are called safe access buffer zones observed around abortion clinics in England. Back in Washington, D.C., President Trump confirmed he'll be meeting Keir Starmer in the next few weeks. Downing Street declined to comment on Mr. Vance's remarks about free speech in the UK. James Hill is political correspondent for The Spectator magazine. James, welcome to The World Tonight. They're going to be walking a delicate tightrope, aren't they, in preparing for this meeting at the White House?
Absolutely. And I think that tonight was a reminder in that speech about how much attention in some ways is paid to domestic British politics by many on the American right. I went to the Republican National Convention in July last year, and it was striking how many issues which you might consider peripheral to contemporary political debate are very much at the forefront of American minds there. So things around free speech, things around the grooming gang scandal, things that get brought up by those on the American right. And J.D. Vance today, in quite a very striking speech, showed how many of the concerns on the British right are shared by those in America as well.
We all know the definition, and I won't use it on polite radio, of what the vice presidency is worth, said by a former vice president himself. Yes. And I know it varies from president to president, depending on how much they use their vice president or whether they lock him or her in a cupboard until the end of the 4 years. But J.D. Vance is, in a sense, not somebody to be underestimated, is he?
No, he's not. And he is very much the most articulate exponent of Trumpism within the White House. He is very much the Trumpist thinker, the intellectual, and he is also seen, of course, as the heir apparent, because we know that, you know, barring a constitutional miracle, this will be Donald Trump's last term, and he is seen as the person who, when he was picked last July, the person who is most likely to succeed him. And so he's positioned himself very effectively, made effective allies with the Trump family. And I think that people in Europe ought to be looking at him because he is the one who is clearly the intellectual powerhouse and the person who will make a lot of running over the next 4 years.
That obviously is helpful to the Reform Party, and we're in a position at the moment where opinion polls, and they don't count for much when there aren't actually any elections taking place, but opinion polls are showing Reform in quite a strong place as compared to the popularity of Labour and the Conservatives. Do they see that link as a valuable link, and how does Keir Starmer navigate his way around that one?
I do think it's a very strong link, and you've just heard from a German politician, the AfD. Parties across Europe were there in January at the inauguration ball and these various events, looking to learn at what lessons they could apply from Trumpism in their own countries. So Estonian Trumpism, German Trumpism, etc. Britain is the most downstream country from America, and Reform UK are very keen to embrace their Trump links. And I think that obviously we've only got, you know, 4 or 5 years left in terms of before the next election. That's a long time, but also, you know, it helps the backing, the prominence of people like Reform if they have Musk potentially making a donation, or if Vance is making comments which are helpful to their cause. And I think in terms of the intellectual headwinds, it is always helpful if you have things like Doge and Elon Musk. That pushes up a kind of cost-cutting agenda, government efficiency agenda, and helps add prominence to backbenchers. Let's not forget, Reform are just 5 MPs in Parliament. When the US Vice President is talking about things that are favourable to their cause, that helps them, no matter who they are.
James Hale, the political correspondent at The Spectator. Thank you. Coming up on The World Tonight in the next 10 minutes, the cellist making music in Manchester with Echoes of Africa.
We start in South Africa with a tune called Tsohle Tsohle, hymns that are connected to a type of Western classical music singing known as four-part harmony, when people sing in four parts from the top all the way to the bass.
But before that, how long can we reasonably expect to live? The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, has published a projection which suggests a continuing rise in the average life expectancy for those yet to be born. If the ONS is right, this will reverse years in which life expectancy has plateaued. Martin McKee is Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and he's been looking at the ONS projections.
So the ONS is using one of the two measures of life expectancy, and it's one of the less widely used ones. Normally, when we say the life expectancy in a particular year is something or other of particular value, 80 years, say, what we're looking at is a synthetic measure of the death rates of people at every age in that year, and we combine it. So it's a theoretical measure, but it's a very useful one. What they are doing is a cohort measure, which basically predicts how long someone who is born in 2023 and 2047, the figures they're looking at, will live. Now, that's rare to do that looking forwards. Normally, when we have cohort life expectancy figures, we're looking at people who were born 100 years ago, and then we have the real data as to how long all of those people lived.
So it is a prediction based, presumably they would say, on kind of statistical evidence. What does that prediction suggest?
The central estimate is that mortality will continue to improve at 1.1% per annum going forwards. They've also looked at a lower figure of 0.5% and a higher figure at 1.5%. And now that would suggest, if we take the central estimate, that a child born in 2023, a boy would live to 86.7 years and a girl to 90 years.
How does that compare to what has actually happened in the last 10 or 20 years in this country? In other words, will it be a shift, if they're correct?
Well, it would be quite a substantial shift. So I've just been looking at the crude mortality and not doing all the calculations they did to allow for changing age distribution. Looking at that, the improvement between 1990 and 2010 was less than 1%, about 0.98%. And then, I think as many people know, life expectancy improvements have really stalled after 2010, particularly after 2012, when austerity hit. And the reduction in mortality then was only 0.14%, which is much lower than their prediction going forward.
So it's fair to say that this would be a shift. And apart from kind of the statistical model, do they offer any other kind of factors that might explain it?
Well, they do have a group that is advising them on this, and I haven't been able to see all of the assumptions that were made. It is incredibly difficult to do this going forward. I was listening to the BBC earlier and they were talking about the risk of the Earth being hit by an asteroid in 2032. Clearly, if we had made these predictions in 2019 before the pandemic, we would have had to come up with a very different view. So we simply don't know.
We feel that probably we've been a lucky generation in terms of our life expectancy. But are there other factors that make that longer living perhaps less attractive than it might once have been?
Well, often when it's presented, it's seen as a problem, which is surprising because living longer should actually be a good thing. And I think that is because people often talk about what's called the old age dependency ratio, the percentage of people who are over 65 compared to younger people. But of course, the reality is that many people who are over 65 are still in the workforce, are enjoying their retirement. The difficulty in the UK is that there are huge inequalities. There's a 10-year gap in life expectancy between the least and the most deprived regions.
10 years
for men and 8 years for women.
Can you give us a contrast of areas? Which are the areas where this is recorded?
So the places that are doing best are in the southeast, particularly around outer London. People often talk about Richmond, Twickenham, places like that as doing very well. The ones that are definitely doing the worst are the coastal towns that have been left behind. Blackpool is always quoted, and those are the regions that have often very high, what are called the deaths of despair, of suicides and drug use and so on.
How does the UK compare to similar sized countries or economies in terms of life expectancy?
Well, first of all, we do better than the United States, but the United States is an outlier that really does terribly badly. But I think the other country that where we would worry about now is Germany, where you also have a rather poor situation. Other countries are doing much better, particularly the Nordic countries and many of the other countries in Europe. Interestingly enough, for a long time, we were doing better than Ireland. And then about 20 years ago, we slipped below them in life expectancy and more of a gap has opened up there. But of course, that's also coinciding with the boom in the Irish economy as well.
Professor Martin McKee. Bantu languages are spoken across vast areas of central, western and southern Africa. On his new album, Hymns of Bantu, the cellist, singer and composer Abel Solochwe pays tribute to his Bantu roots and the western classics he studied in Manchester. The album brings together sounds as diverse as throat singing and Bach. He's been speaking to the BBC's Martin Venard.
Hymns of Bantu is actually about universalities. It's a celebration of our ancestors. When you look back and seeing how they used to govern themselves and celebrating that in musical and sonic form. The music is a hugely eclectic tapestry of sounds. The combination is of many different cultures. So we start in South Africa with a tune called Tsohle Tsohle, hymns that are connected to a type of Western classical music singing known as four-part harmony, when people sing in four parts from the top all the way to the bass. And then we go over to much more improvised music. There's a piece on the album called Dinaka, which is improvised on African percussion, throat singing, and even prepared piano, where we put, you know, blue tack inside the piano to make different sounds. And then we head over to the world of Bach, using the beautiful classical world, but the Bach suite and arranging it for cello and string orchestra. This is something that I also actually grew up with from a very young age, just having the influence of this music at school and having the influence of African music at home.
You say also that there are synergies between the native music of South Africa and Western classical music. In what way?
Pre-colonial thought, people were singing with the idea of the overtone system, where if you sing one note, you hear four notes. That's the natural occurrence of overtones when you sing. And then when colonialism came, I think there was just such a share of culture, but also, you know, trying to understand and trying to live with what was new. And we turned it on its head and put our own voice in it.
You've also said that Bach and throat singing sit together. That's quite an unusual thing to hear.
Yeah, I think the celebration of the sonic space that is just overtones, when, you know, a note resonates in your mouth like a cave, you naturally you hear other notes, and throat singing is embedded in that very concept. And when you sing a Bach chorale and you sing really openly and, you know, you're creating resonance in your mouth, more than you realize, there's more than one note. But the more you practice, the more you hear the other notes.
And when you play, what's the makeup of the audience? Are there classical music fans, fans of world music? Who comes along?
It differs every time. And also, it often depends on the environment. If you play at a concert hall, it would be a certain type of people. If you play at a club, it would be a certain type of people. Now, in the recent times, what I've seen happen is many people entering the concert hall space when they thought before that they couldn't. And that's really my wish, that people come to concert halls and come and enjoy music without being conscious of how they should be or preparing who they should be. But it's
that was Abel Solochwe talking to Martin Venard about his hymns to Bantu. Remember the War on Antisocial Behaviour launched by Tony Blair's government in the late 1990s? Well, the problem is back in the news again, as the number of people who report they're victims of antisocial behaviour rises. The BBC's spoken to one couple about their experience of being harassed and threatened by their neighbour for over a year. They've called the police more than 30 times. Eventually, their neighbour did receive a conviction for harassment and criminal damage. The local council has begun eviction proceedings, but have told the victims it could take many months. Tara Welsh has more.
The neighbour still lives beneath us, despite having criminal convictions against us. We still get abused pretty much daily. So we've been physically threatened, that we'd be shot, stabbed, have our knees broken.
We're completely powerless to stop it.
And I go to you, you s***. Chris
gonna kill you. I'd saved pretty much most of my adult life to be able to buy first property. When I first
I'm sitting with Ben and Emma in their cosy living room. Ben's telling me what life was like when he first moved in.
Seemed like, yes, such a nice kind of community. It was always very quiet, peaceful.
But 6 months later, everything changed when Drina Gray moved into the vacant flat below.
Really loud music playing all through the night. She, at the time, was pet sitting, and they would just be barking, crying, howling.
Ben and his girlfriend Emma said they tried to get help for themselves and their neighbour.
Tried to communicate with her and mediate.
But were ignored.
Despite 160-odd separate complaints, everything's the same.
Be careful!
It's really intimidating because she looks into the cameras and it feels as though she's looking right at you.
Please do not mess with Irish man.
More than a year after the antisocial behaviour started, the neighbour was issued with an official warning, and a council review found there had been failings in the case. But by then, it was too late.
Because I was so sleep deprived, I was getting to work quite late. I couldn't focus on my job. That was being noticed, which resulted in me ultimately losing my job.
What is your problem?
Despite warnings and an action plan from the authorities, the antisocial behaviour continued. In December, Drina Gray pleaded guilty to charges including harassment and causing criminal damage. She'll be sentenced in March. A bail condition was that she wouldn't contact the couple, but they say that's been broken. She was arrested, but returned home afterwards. But after another arrest last month, she was bailed to an address outside the borough, but the couple worry she'll return after she's sentenced. Wandsworth Council have told us that it's seeking possession of the property following the criminal hearing, but says the case is complex. It says it takes antisocial behaviour very seriously, but accepts that it could have acted more swiftly. But this isn't an isolated case. More than a third of people say they've experienced or witnessed antisocial behaviour. That's according to the most recent results from the Crime Survey for England and Wales.
It shows that the system isn't working once again to protect innocent people.
This is Baroness Helen Newlove. She's the Victims Commissioner. She says her inbox is full of messages about this issue.
People were scared of where they lived, scared of going back to their homes. We had people who were going to sit in the local library, say, not to go back to that home till a certain time. That cannot be right. And I don't understand why the agencies really don't get it. They keep fudging it. You know, this
Baroness Newlove's husband, Gary, died after being attacked near his home in Warrington in 2007. He'd gone outside to speak to a gang he believed had been vandalising their car. Ever since, she's been campaigning, but 17 years on, she's concerned the issue is still not taken seriously.
We need further discussions to make sure that antisocial behaviour is raised up a tier. But you watch, the narrative is low level.
She hopes new legislation expected this year will better protect victims.
Why did you contact us?
We contacted you because there was literally no other option left. We've done everything that we've been asked to do. We just wanted somebody to kind of listen and validate that, you know, this isn't what we should be going through.
Ben talking to the BBC's Tara Welsh about living with a neighbour from hell. Let's return to Ukraine and the uncertainty hanging over it ever since Donald Trump revealed a week ago that his administration had a peace plan. One of Ukraine's biggest cultural voices is the novelist Andriy Kurkov, who wrote Death and the Penguin. I interviewed him in Kyiv more than a decade ago, when his biggest fear was the power of oligarchs in his country. His latest book is non-fiction, Our Daily War. I asked Andriy Kurkov how he and other Ukrainians felt after Donald Trump revealed he'd spoken by phone about peace with President Putin.
It's obvious that he is not going to be tough on Putin, because it was like a conversation of equals. And in a way, actually, they look very much alike now, Putin and Trump. Putin with his desire to grab Crimea and half of Ukraine, and Trump with his ambitions to buy Greenland, to take Canada, and to add Panama to the United States of America.
Whatever you say about President Trump, I wonder if one of the things he's done, whether by accident or design, is to lift the lid on some of the hypocrisy in international relations. I mean, we had what we call a rules-based system, but it was a rules-based system that when, for example, Russia annexed Crimea, there was a negotiating process, but there was no return of Crimea to Ukraine. There are other examples around the world where countries act with impunity and the supposed great powers, they don't actually do anything about it.
It's an interesting issue because obviously we didn't have a situation like the annexation of Crimea before the annexation of Crimea. Mm. And there was no reaction, as well as there was no reaction in 2008 when Russia attacked and almost actually reached Tbilisi in Georgia. So, big bear can do what he wants. You can criticize him, you can criticize Russia, you can accuse him officially through International Criminal Court in kidnapping of children, but it doesn't have consequences. So, yes, in this sense, Trump is not a hypocrite, but he is just, behaving in a very rude and also bear-like manner, like all these demands to Ukraine to hand over rare metals in exchange of not clear what. And this actually also makes me worried, because in his talk with Putin, he sounded like a business person. He actually wants to do business with Russia. But what prevents him, this small nuisance, a country where the war is going on, Ukraine. So once the war is over, he will restore the good commercial relations and America will be making money in Russia, and two big bears, two big superpowers will be happy making each other rich.
Are there people who worry now that as a result of Mr. Trump's intervention, that this could be the end of Ukraine?
There are people like this, yes. On social networks, for 2 days after Trump's telephone conversation, but it seems it's going away now. I mean, there are some hopes that are connected with Macron's statements, with Italian politicians' statements, the Europeans who are saying that, no, you cannot just hand over Ukraine to Russia. You cannot accept that the occupied territories are never returned. So I think there will be some kind of balance in the end, but it will be a difficult balance to reach.
Your latest work, Our Daily War, was published last year. Does it still feel to Ukrainians like our war, or does it feel like it's a war really it is in someone else's hands?
No, it is still our war, because it is our people who are killed on the front line and from the missiles and drones. So, I mean, the decisions taken by politicians from other countries, I mean, they are present. Everybody understands what is happening. But still, it is not American war. It is not Russian war. It's not French war. It is Ukrainian war. And it's actually Ukraine who will take all the consequences of this war and take all the responsibilities after the war for the future of the country.
You wrote a wonderful book which satirized the silliness of humanity sometimes in crazy situations in Death and the Penguin. Do you feel your sense of satire as a writer, your sense of humour still intact after this last 3 years?
Not really. I think I lost some part of it, and my humour became much more bitter and maybe more cynical, and I smile myself less often than before. And I hope it will come back.
That was the Ukrainian writer Andriy Kurkov, author of Our Daily War. Our main headline before we leave you: Ukraine's President Zelensky has said he wants security guarantees before he'll enter into talks with President Putin. He was speaking at the Munich Security Conference where he met US Vice President J.D. Vance. I'm Sean Lay. That's The World Tonight. Have a good weekend.